Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM, Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM, Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM, Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM, Albany. I'm Michelle Masurgeon, broadcasting from a closet in my home.
And I'm Alexis, so thankful to be in the studio at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Tonight, we highlight the suspension of burning AFFF at Norlite with longtime local environmental justice activist Aaron Mayer for his perspective on the recent developments with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce.
Then Daniel Mosquera, a professor of Spanish and Latin American, Caribbean, and Hispanic studies at Union College, talks about acclaimed Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman and his new film, The Cordella of Dreams, with HMM correspondent Eileen Aviar.
And after that, we listen in on how community in commemoration of Malcolm X's birthday, on May 19th, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke to the Brothers Organization founder Leon Van Dyke about Malcolm X in part one of two.
Finally, listen in on how community organizers in Troy are doing everything they can to continue to serve the neighborhood's young population as coronavirus lockdown slowly lifts. But first, some headlines. The Times Union reports Schenectady voters will be asked to pass a $204.6 million school budget next month that relies on the elimination of six vacant positions, but no layoffs. The tax levy for the 2021 spending plan remains the same as the current budget. However, the budget was proposed without knowing whether the state will make deep cuts in school aid.
More than 2.4 million Americans filed initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits in the week ending May 16th, down 249,000 from the previous week. In New York, the number of new claims rose to 226,521, up 27,102 from the prior week.
The Daily Gazette reports that Schenectady school board members and district officials are refusing to release or comment on a report prepared for it by a Rochester law firm that apparently concludes former Superintendent Larry Spring engaged in a, quote, pattern, unquote, of pursuing younger women working in the district. The report was apparently in response to a sexual harassment complaint being filed. Spring suddenly resigned after the board received the report.
The Troy Record reports that Rensselaer County saw its highest numbers of recoveries in a single day on Wednesday, with 22 COVID-19 cases cleared. There are now 339 cleared cases in the county. There were six new cases on Wednesday, bringing the total number of confirmed cases to 482 in the county. The age group of 20 to 29 has the highest number of confirmed cases and coincidentally is also the age group that is most likely to be asymptomatic.
Today, the U.S. Department of Defense says it is suspending all shipments of toxic firefighting foam to the Norlite incinerator in Cohoes. Earlier this week, it had suspended a shipment of 58,000 gallons of the foam after widespread protests. The city of Cohoes recently enacted a one-year moratorium on the burning of the foam. EPA also announced a $150,000 fine on Norlite for past environmental violations. Stay tuned in as we will have more on this story today. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. You can always get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
So it's been a busy week for news about the Norlite incinerator in Cohoes. In just the past few hours, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has assessed fines for violation of Norlite's permits, and the Department of Defense has backed away from plans to ship more toxic waste to Cohoes. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce spoke to longtime environmental justice activist Aaron Mayer for his perspective on the recent developments.
Norlite's been an old issue. Norlite's been something that I've actually engaged with the communities up in Latham to say, hey, when they were cooking shale and stuff up in that area, the smokestacks up there, says, hey, you know, one of the releases from this stuff is mercury gas. And this is a profound neurotoxin. And you say, hey, folks, you know, you understand what's coming out of the smokestack. And this was in the wake of us finding out what's coming out of the Answers incinerator. But everybody in that section or the prevailing winds from Norlite are, you know, they're upper middle class and upper income families. And they just figured the fact that they live in, you know, modern split level homes, that because their neighborhoods are green and look clean, that they were somehow immune to the toxins that are coming out of Norlite. And it's said that it's taken over decades for them to realize that their health is at serious risk. And Norlite has been a festering concern and cancer and blight upon that section of Albany County. And, you know, and it will continue to be so until, you know, some aggressive, serious action that factors in the impact of those regulated polluting gases upon human health. And until that's elevated as the centermost argument, you're not going to see serious action taken. You know, remember when, you know, Dr. Stone, you know, went after Lafarge by just testing the blood of some of the children, which in the Ravenna Selkirk area, and the cooking of the cement and the impact on human health there, you know, pretty much that was the end of his career. And even when Harvard offered to step in to do human health blood studies to see what the impact of these neurotoxins would be on the local population, the state health department pretty much stopped the study and declared that any action by an outside entity would be illegal. So it seemed that more help went to allow for a polluted facility, or what they call a regulated facility, to, you know, to continue to operate within legal regulations, but regulations that still destroy human health, to this day is still allowed to operate. So the answer is, you know, is not just at the local level, but at, you know, looking at our state Senate and assembly, as well as a governor, to take these things and elevate these policies to the point where human health is elevated over the profits of these private sector companies.
Well, the EPA recently released a notice fining Norlite $150,000 for
chump change
for violating the terms of its permit for a number of years. And they say that the emissions, they exceeded the maximum gas exit temperature, which is necessary to control emissions of dioxins and furans, and also the parameters for the operation of the scrubber, which controls for emissions of hydrogen chloride, chlorine gas,
right,
and particulate matter.
But here's the thing. They're actually talking about a COVID exemption for polluting facilities like that right now under Trump's EPA. So when people say the EPA, they speak of it as an institutional monolith without recognizing who's running it. And if the current administration that's running it means that it was not good in the first place because of politics, it's absolutely worse now. And the issue is that, you know, it's not so much that you flag them and fine them. The fines are just nothing more than the cost of doing business. So if you're only getting a $150,000 fine, but you're making a few hundred million dollars in profits, then it's a fine that you're willing to pay. And companies have recognized, and part of the ugly game is that we think that we have agencies out there that are protecting human health. No, the fines are inadequate, but also the enforcement powers are inadequate, because county health commissioners or state health commissioners can't go in and just unilaterally shut these facilities down. And, you know, and what needs to be reformed is that they need to have full liability. It needs to be tort reform to allow for people and property damaged and impacted by this should be able to sue them, you know, for the maximum amount possible allowable under the law. But that, again, has to be coming from the people to get those laws on the books so that these companies can be truly held accountable and liable. As long as it's still profitable for them to pollute, and by polluting, kill people and damage the environment, they are, the fact that they got slapped on the hand with a feather of enforcement still will not deter them from continually engaging and aberrant behavior that results in putting human health and the environment at risk.
So you successfully created a coalition that shut down the Energy Answers Plan in Albany after many years. Mm-hmm. What would you advise the folks organizing around Norlite to do?
Well, that's the most important activism is grassroots activism. When your democracy fails you and does not result in the regulation and policies that you need to have black letter laws written so that they're protective of your health, and not just your health in your backyard. And this is a thing that communities just don't get. The NIMBY style of just only if it happens to me, then it's real, and thinking, you know, has to become universal. You know, that whole segment of the area, you know, of Albany County that's now facing that plant, you know, they've been facing it for years. But they also saw us facing and battling the Answers incinerator. And, the thing is that they're going to have to realize that they're going to have to expand your democracy, expand your inclusion, and educate not only themselves and their community, but their legislators on, you know, the price of poor public policy that results in zoning and permits that allows a facility like Norlite to operate. They have to not just be against Norlite or what's in their backyard. They have to be against all regulated facilities like that put human health and the environment at risk. And the most important thing is what we have that's a critical part of our democracy, which is organize, register to vote, find out all the politicians that represent that area and that region, and get them on the public record. And they have a chance every November and every primary season, whether it's in spring or summer, to elect and vote out those who are supporting that facility until you get the democracy that you need. But democracy is not a passive sport where you just file a complaint. You have to be engaged. And one of the things that an environmental justice community had to do, we had to basically deal with our failed democracy that resulted in politicians who wrote rules that allow situations like Norlite to exist. And if you can't find a politician to support them, by God, in the words of Bernie Sanders, run for office yourself. You know, don't be afraid. Just because, you know, they own your existing politicians or your existing county party, then take it over. You know, the grassroots part of America is that we approach things like we're shopping at a shopping mall. Our democracy is not like shopping. You know, our democracy is very entrepreneurial, and it's very much about you being engaged and owning your product and being stewards of your product and protecting and defending your product. You just can't say, well, once we got a law, then we can go get some, we can all go sit down. Well, guess what? Just like you saw with Donald Trump following in the wake of Barack Obama, another elected politician by the other side comes in and he rips everything up. So you have to not only fight and gain these offices and to rewrite these regulations and policies, you must also fight and sustain it as well. So vigilance on top of change is going to be very, very critical to any grassroots organizing. That has to be done. There's no option. There's no option. There's no cavalry coming in because you placed a call that the EPA is going to come and ride to your safety. The EPA right now is controlled by a White House that's put in a corporate lobbyist, a coal lobbyist that's running the EPA, who believes that pollution is fine because it's a private property right of a polluter to pollute.
And we just heard HMM correspondent Steve Pierce interviewing longtime local environmental justice advocate Aaron Mayer for his perspective on the recent developments at the Norlite plant in Cohoes.
Up next, Daniel Mosquera is currently a professor of Spanish and Latin American, Caribbean and Hispanic Studies and interim director of the Latin American and Caribbean Studies program at Union College in Schenectady, New York. He talks about acclaimed Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman and his new film, The Cordillera of Dreams, interviewed by HMM correspondent Eileen Javier.
Hello, this is Eileen for the Wholesome Mohawk Magazine, and I am here today with Daniel Mosquera. We will be talking about Patricio Guzman, about his new documentary, Cordillera of Dreams. Welcome, Daniel, to the Wholesome Mohawk Magazine. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm very good. Daniel, can you tell us a little bit about you?
Well, I am a professor of Latin American and Caribbean studies and Hispanic studies and Spanish as well at Union College. I work in the Department of Modern Languages. Have been there for nearly 23 years, and I am a resident of Albany and a very, very happy patron and contributor of the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
And how do you get to meet Patricio Guzman?
I met him for the first time in 2011 when Steve and the Sanctuary for Independent Media made arrangements to screen his film Nostalgia for the Light. I had the opportunity to interview him separately and also to be a simultaneous translator during the Q&A that they held after the screening.
And what can you tell us about Patricio Guzman?
Patricio is one of the best known documentary filmmakers in Latin America since the early 1970s to the present. He is representative of a minority of filmmakers that are dedicated to addressing themes that are very existential, historical, and political in nature. And I think Patricio Guzman is very unique in having successfully and in a very provocative way bridged lyrical narratives that have a very strong political character to them. And he's been able to do that also in a way that confront us, but also invite us to an incredibly rich cinematic experience. His films are just exquisite to watch, very difficult to watch as well, because they're intellectually and emotionally complex and hard to see, because he deals with themes that very frequently are difficult for people to address. And you know, one of those topics very consistent throughout his filmic career is the relationship between people and memory, and also the relationship between memory and the possibility of existence or human existence. And so that's the reason why I believe that his films are so necessary, but at the same time, they're not easy. They require deep engagement on the part of an audience.
On his three movies, The Nostalgia for the Light, 2010, he focused on the Atacama Desert. The Pearl Bottom, in 2015, he focused on the water. And now, in the third movie, The Cordillera of the Dreams, he focused on the Cordillera, but most importantly, the coup d'etat and Santiago. Why would you think that it's so important for Patricio to use geographical points in Chile, and he, since that he put them together with political situations in Chile, but also focuses on preserving that memory for the people?
I think that this emphasis on natural markers like mountain ranges, water sources, or water landscapes, and the desert, that they feature so prominently in his three films, because they represent for the Chilean cultural imagination kind of almost like cosmic points of orientation, right? Chile is a country that is flanked by the Pacific Ocean on one side, for instance, and by the Andes mountain range on the other, and at the same time by the Patagonia region, the southern pole, southern portion of Chile, and the northern Atacama Desert. And so they represent both sort of material and symbolic reminders of this inevitable relationship that we have with nature. And so even in modern, you know, throughout the modernization of the country, I would argue that these natural markers remain a constant in the spiritual, but also in the cultural memory for the people. And so there's no question that, that Patricio Guzman has been able to, from a personal side, connect very deeply with this natural reference, but also has had the creative impetus to see this reference also as witnesses of Chilean memory. And so bringing them into conversation with the people through cinema, through film, I think makes it possible for him to touch people at different levels, not only through a narrative way, but also through images and through ideas that are evocative of aspects of life that people forget about. And it's very interesting that you asked that question, because now in the pandemic, one thing that has become very salient in people's ways of understanding what is happening is discovering that nature is kind of there. That all of a sudden people are discovering creatures and spaces and sounds that they had ignored for a long time as the noise of modernity blinded us to that. I'm not kind of romanticizing that. And so I think that for Patricio Guzman is both a personal goal, because nature has imprinted him with these images, with the smells, with the sounds, with the presence throughout his entire life. And I think more powerfully so in the context of his exile. Right, but also because he sees all of these natural markers also as instruments of evocation that can help the Chilean people understand themselves as well.
Like you said, suddenly we are realizing about parks that always have been there, but we never noticed. His exile, you said, he had to leave, or?
Well, he had to leave as many other activists. And artists, people of different walks of life in the context of the dictatorship and the installment of a very repressive regime that at the time had the sanctioning of countries like the U.S. that had participated not only in enabling the violence that the Pinochet's dictatorship represented and put in practice, but also nurtured that violence. And so Patricio Guzman, as I understand it, left in that particular context. He also left in order to protect the register of the filmic material that he had been able to produce, which comprised the Battle for Chile trilogy, the three parts of this long testimony of pre-dictatorship, Unidad Popular history, the rise of Salvador Allende, the emergence of incredibly affirming democratic processes and energies, but at the same time, the different ways in which people began to understand those democratizing forces as a sign of positivism and hope. And so he filmed all of that, filmed the coup d'etat, the assassination of Allende, trauma that all of this occasioned in different segments of the population. And then after that, in order to be able to protect the testimonies, he took them outside of the country. But these are specific, there's probably a specific detailed things about this event that, he would be best answering himself.
Okay. If there is anything else that I have not asked that you will wanted to say about Patricio Guzman?
He's a well-known internationally filmmaker. His films are however not commercial in nature. They're intended for the people, but very frequently they do not reach the people. And so La Batalla de Chile was forbidden in Chile until he returned, I think more than 15 years after that, after Pinochet was removed himself from government and Chile entered a democratic process, then Patricio came back and showed some of these films, but they were forbidden. I would say that today the content and the themes of his films are incredibly relevant to all of us everywhere, and particularly relevant to the realities that we've witnessed globally in the last decade or so, this kind of rise of anti-democratic forces, oligarchic, aided by oligarchic influences and by a very strong presence of corruption. And, you know, how all of this converges into violence and intolerance is something that his films speak to. And so I think that just encourage everybody to try to see the film, also try to gain some historical insight by watching the films that are already available through YouTube and other sites. And that'd be all.
Thank you for taking the time to talking with us today.
My pleasure. See you on Friday.
That was an interview with Daniel Mosquera, a professor of Spanish and Latin American, Caribbean, and Hispanic studies at Union College, talking about acclaimed Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman and his new film, The Cordillera of Dreams, with HMM correspondent Eileen Javier. In a benefit for the Sanctuary for Independent Media, The Cordillera of Dreams is available to watch on demand through May 28th, 2020, at www.mediasanctuary.org, and there will be a live Q&A with the filmmaker on Friday, May 22nd, from 4 to 5:30 p.m.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And continuing, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Eileen Javier speaks to the acclaimed Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman, who last appeared at the Sanctuary for Independent Media back in 2011 for an update on his work. The translator is Union College professor Daniel Mosquera.
You came 11 years with nostalgia for the light, the first in your trilogy, and now we're together with you with your final film of the trilogy, La Cordillera of Dreams. In each, there is a great focus on nature and sense of place. Can you speak about how you position nature as a filmmaker in your works?
En Chile, no puedes alejarte de la naturaleza.
Patricio is saying that that it is very difficult to be in Chile without thinking about nature, because nature is a constant presence in Chilean life. Either you are flanked by the mountain range on one side or by the ocean on the other. And so water and the mountains are both present as both kind of limits to the country, but also defining elements in this corridor, because Chile is not an expansive country, it's a very narrow and long country, and both the mountain range and the ocean, sort of define it. If you stand in Valparaíso, for instance, and look into the ocean, you see 15,000 kilometers of nothing but water, and so you have to grapple with this presence of the horizon and this sense of expansiveness. So nature is very, very strong because it inspires and also pushes Chilean people toward it. And so it's very attractive because it is inevitable. He said that, that he has never had this sensation anywhere else. He lives in France, and France, has green spaces and parks and so forth and so on. But nature is not as present. There's a lot of demographic density. There's a lot more people. And so, one fourth of Chile is all is occupied. The rest of the country is not. And so nature is inevitable. It's a very strong presence.
You speak in your film about your creative life in exile and deep sense of dislocation. How is the role of cultural imagination vital for you and for everyone in the struggle for liberation?
Es una pregunta difícil de responder.
It is a very difficult question to answer.
Porque en Chile, antes de del golpe de estado.
Patricio is saying that as I said, that this is a very difficult question to answer. But in his mind, the way he explains it is that he since the time that he was a child, he felt a sense of detachment and also kind of a feeling of solitude that he has nurtured always, and that made it possible for him when he went in exile to be able to handle it. And to explain it to himself that way. So this feeling has been with him much before the coup in 1973. And then at the same time, you know, he has always felt like an outsider, but at the same time, he has obsessed about Chile from the very beginning. And so he has this kind of contradictory but unifying set of forces that define his creativity. He cannot explain it in any other way. Maybe a psychiatrist or psychologist could explain it, but he doesn't have a sense of belonging in that way. He lived in Spain. He's been to Mexico, he's been to many other places, but he doesn't have kind of that feeling of belonging to places. Finally, he concludes that, you know, each artist has a personal universe that is not entirely logical in the way they define it. And so he feels that his reflects that sort of relativity that is also anchored in very specific, materially definable places, like Chile.
The lessons of your film seem so relevant, especially now in our current crisis of the pandemic, as fascism and oligarchy continue to dominate. What do the lessons of Chile reveal to the world today and for our future?
Well, lo principal es lo que está pasando en Chile. Quiero decir de que hay una revolución en marcha.
The answer is that we need to look at what is happening in Chile right now, that there's kind of a revolution in place without leaders, without any defined leadership, without specific concrete objectives, decentralized, without any definitive sense of the future. So people don't know what this political effervescence, revolutionary effervescence is going to lead to. That is very multiple. There are many people, millions of people coming out, many of them without any signs, without any political definitive aspirations, but expressing their feelings and discontent. And all of this is kind of a mystery. And so he sees this happening as well in countries like France and many other places, including also the Arab regions. Where these revolutionary expressions and movements are happening, and that, you know, that this is an accumulating force that is beginning to emerge, that is fantastic, that is also potentially dangerous, and that they represent an incredible opportunity for artists of all shapes to explore and to try to document. And that is just very interesting for everybody to both participate in and also to register.
You will be speaking with us in a Vida Media workshop, which is key to our mission at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. The role of the independent filmmaker Pablo is so critical. How does he inspire, and what can we learn from him as artists and filmmakers and community organizers in this challenging time? Anything else that you would like to say about that specific person, Pablo?
Pablo tiene algo extraordinario.
He would like to answer the question by talking about Pablo, Pablo Salas, that he is a very kind of unique character because he handles the camera as if he were a writer, a poet, instead of a filmmaker. He goes out every day to record everything that is happening. He doesn't go out with the script in hand. He doesn't have a specific scheme to work from. He just registers and witnesses what happens. And the only motivation that brings him to do that is his desire to be a witness and his desire to register what happens in his country. And this becomes an example for all of us filmmakers and not professional and not a street journalists and anybody who is interested in being both a witness and an activist. To do that. And so he's very special in that sense, but he's also an everyman or every human in many other contexts.
Anything else that you would like to share today with us, Patricio?
No.
No, he doesn't have anything to add. He's just really happy to have connected with us and that he's looking forward to a conversation on Friday that looks very much like this one, that has been very very pleasant for him and very enlightening, and that he looks forward to being able to be useful, and he's very happy that people have liked his film.
Thank you for your inspiration as a filmmaker. We're so honored to share your film and hear your words of wisdom at the sanctuary. You are virtually, but you are so connected to our hearts. Thank you for giving us the time. Okay?
Sí.
Can't wait to see you.
Sí, mil gracias por todo, por conectarte y conectar tu trabajo con nuestros corazones, nuestras mentes. Y que nada, que esperamos con ansia el viernes para ver a dónde nos lleva todo.
Muchas gracias a
So thank you to all of us.
Thank you.
Patricio Guzman will be featured in a virtual Be the Media workshop on Friday, May 22nd, and he will be discussing his new film, The Cordillera of Dreams, which is available to watch on demand through May 28th, 2020, and a benefit for the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Visit mediasanctuary.org for more information about the workshop and screening.
Next, Malcolm X was born on May 19th, 1925, and assassinated on February 21st, 1965. Malcolm provided Black Americans with a significant interpretation of history and an anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist worldview. Malcolm X had a profound impact on America and is considered one of the most influential leaders of the 20th century. In this part one segment, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke with the Brothers Organization founder, Leon Van Dyke, about Malcolm X.
Willie Terry, a roaming labor correspondent, and I have with me Leon Van Dyke, former member of the Brothers, right?
Right.
And tomorrow is Malcolm X's birthday, Leon. Just give me some of your thoughts on Malcolm.
His funeral, Malcolm was our Black Prince. He was articulate, one who actually took no prisoners, was fearless in his defense of Black people. And as a young man, I certainly, as many young Black men during that time, revered Malcolm. And he was one of our inspirations in terms of the civil rights movement, in terms of the Black Power movement. He was exceptional man.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leon, you were one of the organizers of the Brothers.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Tell me something about the Brothers, and how your involvement, and did Malcolm influence you y'all in any way?
Malcolm influenced. If you were a young Black man in the North, Malcolm was our leader. He inspired us in so many ways. And, I mean, even now to the day, the things that Malcolm said about race, about discrimination, about standing up and being proud. Malcolm was the epitome of I'm Black and I'm proud. The Brothers in Albany, they rose around about 1965. inspired, and it's on the record, inspired by both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And we see no contradiction in having these two exceptional men as our inspiration. The brothers, it was organized by black inner city men who got tired of accepting the discrimination and segregation that we were, that our people were facing. So we started in terms of protesting against the discrimination of blacks in the construction industry in the mid-60s when they were building the Empire State Plaza and other edifices.
Did you ever see Malcolm?
I saw him speak because when Minister Mohammed sent Malcolm to clean up Temple 12, that was like two blocks from where I lived. So I seen Malcolm, and many of my peers at that time joined the Muslims. I was wilding, as the kids say today. I just wasn't ready, but I knew of Malcolm, and he was respected as a fiery minister that talked about white people that we had not heard before during that time.
There's a film out about Malcolm and the assassination. I don't know if you heard about that. That film?
I've seen a number of those
by Netflix.
Documentary. In fact, as your audience might not know, in 1970, I worked for the Department of Corrections as a director of their Title I program, and one of the persons. And his name eludes me right now. But one of the persons that were charged with the murder of Malcolm was at Comstock, New York. And I got to talk to him. And he swore up and down to me, which that he had not did it. I myself personally believe that the CIA or the FBI had something to do with it.
Yeah, that's always the struggle when, you know, these documentaries come out about his assassination. The struggle between did the nation do it, Islam, or was it the government?
And Malcolm said when he was going over sees talking and in London and all these places, and that he was being followed around, and he said, Malcolm said that he didn't believe it was the nation of the Muslims of Islam that had him followed, because they didn't have that capability to follow and to tap his phones, and he really felt as if that it was the FBI or the CIA that was following him around. And we know that when we look at other leaders who oppose our policy, that it is not above the CIA or the FBI to assassinate these people if they see them as a threat. So certainly the FBI and the CIA had the capabilities of doing all these things, and even getting people involved that didn't even know that they were being manipulated. I think that the FBI and the CIA had something to do with it. Now, an aside thing, which you may or may not know, the brothers telephoned was tapped for 3 years in Albany. That's on the record. It was an article written about that. And then in the Counterintelpro program that was to keep track of activism back in those days, the brothers was one of the groups that the FBI kept in contact with. So to say that that the FBI wasn't involved, it belies all of the things that we know that these agencies have done in the past. I mean, it goes back to Marcus Garvey, goes back to W.E.B. Du Bois, who the FBI called Marcus Garvey the most dangerous black man in America, who, and by the way, J. Edgar Hoover called Martin Luther King the most dangerous black man in America.
You know, I always wonder now, like, you know, we're in this COVID-19 situation. Mm-hmm. And I was saying that, you know, if Malcolm was around today, where would we be at now?
Well, I think Malcolm, we look at his words in terms of when we look at this COVID-19 virus pandemic that we have that is disproportionately has an impact on African Americans and other people of color, such as Native Americans, Latinos, Asians, has a disproportionate, and is directly due to the inadequate health services and care that they have taken, that they are exposed to, then Malcolm would say it is our system, is the inadequate health system that does not serve African Americans well. That's the cause of blacks being disproportionately affected by this thing. And you know, we have an unfair health system that needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. I think Malcolm would have addressed himself to that because he was a deep thinker, you know. So the things that I hear some of the people, some of our activists today speaking, they'd be right on point, and Malcolm be right there with them.
And I always say that, you know, Malcolm talks a lot about, like you said, about the government, is that he probably would be in self-quarantine based on this virus, but I think he'll be telling us, don't trust the government. Don't believe what they said, how this thing started.
Yeah, you had to be simple-minded to believe, to take on face value what our government is telling us. Mm-hmm. And besides that, simple-minded in terms of believing on face value what our government, when we have lied, they have lied to us so many times. And this is not just black people being simple-minded. Whether you any color, to just take on face value that, our government says this, so it must be true. It belies the historical record.
You just heard part one of an interview with Leon Van Dyke, founder of the Brothers Organization. He was talking with roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry in honor of Malcolm X's birthday. Hold on, Michelle. Go ahead.
Up next, activities for youth and children are essential to the community, but summer programs remain in limbo as lockdown slowly lifts. However, community organizers in Troy are doing everything they can to continue to serve their neighborhood's young population.
We're delighted to speak now with Jeff Curry, who is an organizer of the Speak Out program and the FACE program, and will be present at the Troy United event this Saturday.
Hello.
Jeff, welcome to the show. Jeff, can you tell us, well, first, I guess let's start with the Speak Out program. Tell us about it.
Well, the Speak Out program is basically for kids ages 6 to 21. What we do is We're at Unity House on the second floor for about usually an hour on Mondays and Wednesdays, hour and a half. And the first half, what we usually do is sit down with the kids and let them feel comfortable of explaining themselves and what bullying is. They explain to us what bullying is. We talk to them. We ask about situations they've been in and to see, like, what's the scariest part of being bullied and how to handle a bullying situation if it's them or someone else being bullied. The address is 6 and Hoosick in the city of Troy, New York. It's Unity House right there on the corner of 6 and Hoosick. You'll see it. It says it right on the building, Unity House. We're on the second floor every Monday and Wednesday, 5:30 to 7 o'clock, starting right after we're clear to go back in the building.
And how do you address bullying on social media?
Well, what we do is we tell, well, first what we do with the kids, we tell them, report the first sign of it. Even if it seems little, innocent, if it seems like they're being pushy, avoid that conversation and let your parents know or let an adult know so they can see what's going on.
And how many kids participate in this program?
We have average anywhere from probably 12 to 18 a day, well, every Monday and Wednesday.
And, you know, how do you see bullying increasing, decreasing, or about the same since kids have been out of school?
Well, I believe it's increasing now since they've been out of school because they have nothing else to do except bother other kids. So I feel like it's increased since we've been out of school.
And are there ways that you're working to address that as a, you know, remote issue?
Yes. Well, we did. Well, we tried to figure out a way around the epidemic and how we could do it with spacing and still get out to the kids. So when we started yesterday, we started going outside to the parking lot of school too, where the spacing is 9 feet apart and the kids still wear their masks. We get together and we do some exercise and we see if there's anything bothering the kids or any situation or is there anyone that they're trying to help and anything we could do to help them right now at this point.
And do the kids seem pretty, like, that works for them?
Yeah, it works. Like, most of the kids, they can lecture a whole class themselves and teach other kids about bullying now after being there. Like, some of them been there longer than a year. Some of them been there a couple months. But most of them came in, a couple of them came in shy. But now they want to speak out. They want to stand up. They want to show other kids what bullying is, what to do in case of a bullying. So I believe it's very effective for the kids.
And you also helped to coordinate a basketball program called the FACE program. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's for ages 6 to 13. I've been running for about 4 summers now. It's just something extra for the kids to do to give them other options in the summertime because all kids can't afford summer camp. So I give them another option because the basketball league is free, shirts are free, food is free. You just got to show up on Tuesdays and Thursdays, play basketball if that's what you like to do, and to give you another option at life.
So where does the FACE program meet?
The FACE program meet on 7th and Angles in the park. They're redoing the park right now. So if anybody went by, we're still going to be there this year. They're going to be finished by the summer. So it's on 7th and Angles in the city of Troy.
I did hear that the basketball nets are back up in the parks. Is that true?
Someone told me that we put lids on the ones under the bridge when the epidemic started, but someone told me that the lids was off this weekend. So I'm not sure how true it is, so I'm going to ride by and see, and then I'm going to sit down and probably talk to the mayor and see what's the guidelines for this for running the basketball league for the summer because I want to make sure everyone stays safe.
Right. Can you just talk about, you know, the need for kids programs and for youth programs in our community, especially when school is out?
The need for the programs is very important because if we don't give these kids something to do, they're going to be into other things. And by giving them something to do, we know we're helping them for their future. We're teaching them being part of something is important than just being out here, just doing whatever, hanging around, looting, or whatever the case may be. Like, for This is my second year. Sergeant from Troy Police told me he loved the league. And I was like, well, why? He was like, because all the kids I had trouble with last summer before this started, they're all here. So I know where they're all at. They're not doing nothing. They're in the park. They're playing. And I know crime is down from the hours of 4 to 9 every Tuesday and Thursday. So that's why I'm allowed to even be able to stop by, hang out, and meet the kids here. And it's very important for the kids because seeing that police presence there, they get to know the police, and then they don't label themselves as a snitch when they feel like there's a problem.
So there is an activity taking place this weekend, the Troy United event at the Troy Central Little League at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Can you talk about your role in that?
Yes. We combined with several other organizations in the city of Troy. We came together to give away hand sanitizer, gloves, face masks, hot dogs, and hamburgers. Hot dogs and hamburgers was because it was the weekend of Memorial Day. And we know some parents haven't been working, so it's a little bit difficult for food to come by. So we just decided to do that. And the face masks, gloves, and the hand sanitizer was due to the fact because everybody doesn't have access to these things. So we wanted to make sure we make it a little bit easier in trying to help get rid of this pandemic. So what we did was we're giving away sanitizer to each family. We go give away sanitizer, gloves, face masks, and food. They don't have to bring the whole family down. They could come and say, for instance, if they got 4 kids, we'll put 4 hamburgers, 4 hot dogs in the bag. Information about the programs that we still, what that's still offering, people who may help you can still talk to people. It's several things going on down there this weekend.
So I'm really excited to see that this event is going on. And if listeners want to, we'll start with Speak Out. If listeners want to reach out to Speak Out or maybe enroll in it, who do they contact?
They could contact Carol Pryor or they could contact myself. And we'll let them know the days, times. And Kevin also, he makes it upon himself sometimes to even pick up the kid if a parent just can't get there in time. He'll pick the child up if need be. They arrange that when they talk to him. And he will be down there this Saturday at one of the tables with information also.
So they can go the Saturday. Is there a phone number they can call?
It's phone. I don't want to give out a personal phone number. Mm-hmm. But I don't have his extra phone number.
Or maybe right now, social media. Is there a Facebook page?
Yeah, you can go on Facebook, social media, go to Kevin Pryor, and you'll see his picture, and it says Speak Out program, and you just click right on. He'll get back to you immediately, usually within 10, 15 minutes.
And then for the FACE program, where can listeners go to get updates on that?
The FACE program, we're doing sign-ups this Saturday just to get started. We're doing this Saturday. They can go to my page, Jeff Curry on Facebook also. And my phone number is, I can give out my phone number, 518-606-0773. And, I mean, if you need an application, I'll drop it off or you come get it. But usually we like to have kids signed up by the middle of June so we can make sure everyone has a uniform that fits.
So this has been Jeff Curry. He helps to coordinate the FACE basketball program, the Speak Out anti-bullying program, and is also helping one of the co-organizers for this weekend's event, Troy United. It's taking place this Saturday, May 23rd at 2 p.m. at Troy Central Little League, 3130 7th Avenue. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Alexis, co-host and engineer. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or would like to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Have a wonderful evening.